is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we're enlightening you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana
in the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Washington approves a potential weapons sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia amid anger over the kingdom's devastating war in Yemen. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says Tehran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions imposed on the country. Also ahead, Sudan's army chief, who led a military coup last month, orders the release of four ministers amid international efforts to end the African country's political crisis. Good to have you with us. The Saudi United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. The Pentagon says the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million and is being seen as the first major military sale to Saudi Arabia under President Joe Biden. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed another weapons sale worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The weapons sales have sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's engagement in a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the Saudi onslaught. Sarah Flounders is the co-director at International Action Center. She believes the U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia contradicts Joe Biden's campaign promises and serves no one but the arms manufacturing companies.
Well, this is just the latest U.S. breaking of commitments. Certainly, President Biden did again and again commit during the election campaign. He called Saudi Arabia a pariah state and said that all weapons sales would be ended. And of course, that's not what's happened. And this is not even the first. In September, there was a $500 million helicopter parts and maintenance contract that was signed. So this, along with the $650 million on air-to-air missiles, it's over $1 billion in U.S. direct supplies to Saudi Arabia. All the talk about leading with diplomacy and ending the war on Yemen, these are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapons sales, which benefit Raytheon, benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
President Ibrahim Raisi says Iran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions on the country. Raisi says Iran will not abandon the negotiating table, but will refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes the U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust and Washington needs to remove them. Iran has confirmed that talks with the P4 plus one, the remaining parties to the nuclear accord, are set to begin on November 29. The negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran after former President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in 2018. Political commentator David Yehoubian says the United States cannot even guarantee that it will stay in the nuclear deal through Biden's presidency.
The Biden administration refuses to commit to the JCPOA and what would be American commitments to drop all of its sanctions under the agreement. Instead, seeking to maintain the ability for the United States to maintain some of its commitments and then withdraw from some of its commitments at will. And specifically and most importantly, the Biden administration isn't even guaranteeing that it will stay within the agreement for the duration of President Biden's term, even if Iran meets all of its commitments. So I think this is the context for President Raisi's statements, as well as Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian representative to international institutions in Vienna, that it's time to have a results-oriented discussion that is designed to bring all parties back into full compliance with their JCPOA commitments. And for the United States, this would require it to drop all of the sanctions from the term of President Trump, and as well the sanctions that were maintained after the accord was signed in 2015 by the Obama administration.
Iran's naval forces have foiled the recent U.S. attempt to steal an Iranian oil shipment in the Sea of Oman. This is yet another victory for Tehran's against Washington's ongoing adventurism and threats to regional peace and stability. The following is a summary of the Islamic Republic's achievements in containing the United States' muscle flexing in the region during the last couple of years.
Tensions between Tehran and Washington have been simmering for decades. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the U.S. has routinely sought to undermine Iran's regional and global influence. In recent years, with the U.S.'s ever-expanding presence in West Asia, confrontations between Tehran and Washington reached their boiling point on several occasions. But a majority of American plots and measures against Iran have ended in failure. In 2019, Iran shot down an intruding U.S. spy drone over its southern province of Hormuzgan using a domestically manufactured surface-to-air missile. The wreckage of the UAV indicated it had violated Iran's airspace. Officials then said the downing was in response to Washington's repeated violations of the country's airspace. Military experts believe the downing of the $123 million drone was the first known example of sophisticated American UAVs being hit in their operational history. In January 2020, then-US President Donald Trump ordered an airstrike in Iraq to assassinate Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani. The commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps' Quds Force was killed near Baghdad Airport along with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units, also known as Hashd al-Sha'bi. 5 days after Washington's belligerent move, Iran targeted the U.S. Ain al-Assad airbase in Iraq's Anbar province with at least a dozen ballistic missiles. According to American media reports, U.S. troops are still dealing with the consequences, with many suffering from mental trauma. The attack is considered to be the largest ballistic missile strike against American troops in modern history. However, U.S. Adventurers Eurocentrism is not limited solely to Iran's growing influence. In the same year, the U.S. Justice Department caused a controversy by claiming that Washington had seized Iranian fuel tankers destined for Venezuela. That was amid a pledge by the Trump administration to bring Iran to its knees by bringing the country's crude exports to zero. However, in an effort to cope with Washington's crippling sanctions and pressures, Tehran and Caracas continued their cooperation in the energy sector. But again, on October 25, 2021, the U.S. resorted to an act of piracy with a futile attempt to hamper Iranian oil export, this time in the Sea of Oman. But Iranians once again emerged victorious after the IRGC's naval forces took control of the tanker and safely steered it towards Iranian territorial waters. The failure of U.S. warships and helicopters to block the tanker's path is a testimony of bravery and preparedness of the Iranian forces. These are just a few examples of many such plots hatched by the U.S. and some of its allies to target the Iranian nation. However, they have been in line with Washington's disastrous legacy, under which it has maintained the military presence in the region. But its failed policies, especially the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, have made it crystal clear that U.S. hegemony in the region and beyond is waning at a very rapid pace.
Welcome back. Now moving on, Sudan's army chief has ordered the release of four civilian ministers who were detained as part of a military coup he led last month. They include the ministers of telecommunication, trade, information, as well as youth and sports. Still no word on when they will be released. The order came after the army chief's media advisor said the government formation is imminent. The move also came after Army Chief Fatah al-Burhan spoke with the UN Secretary General on the phone. Antonio Guterres urged Burhan to restore the civilian-led transitional government. That's the latest in international efforts to restore the democratic transition in Sudan. Last Monday, the army dissolved the government and detained the civilian leadership. The move sparked days of deadly mass protests across the country. A post-Brexit dispute over fishing rights between France and the UK seems far from over as a new round of talks fails to settle significant differences. Paris has refused to rule out planned sanctions on London. The French Europe minister said the issue of fishing licenses is yet to be resolved. He said all options are on the table should the talks fail. The minister made the remarks after a meeting with the British Brexit minister in Paris. More talks are planned for next week. Tensions escalated last week when a UK boat was seized after entering waters around France. In response, France threatened to impose restrictions on British trawlers and goods, but it pulled back later to create space for dialogue. Paris says many French boats have been denied fishing permits by the UK, saying the move contradicts the Brexit deal.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU Common Fisheries Policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. And not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag indicate its opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pourriza, Dover, United Kingdom.
The U.S. Congress approves legislation to hike diplomatic pressure on the Nicaraguan government in the run-up to the country's presidential election. The legislation provides a host of measures to address what Washington calls corruption and human rights abuses by the government of President Daniel Ortega. This includes a series of sanctions against people involved in alleged human rights abuses. In the past months, police have arrested a number of opposition figures in the Latin American country for inciting foreign interference. Nicaragua is to hold a presidential election on Sunday, in which Ortega is expected to win a fourth consecutive term. Ahmed Cabello is in Nicaragua. Earlier he joined us to talk about the upcoming presidential election in the country. Let's see what he had to say.
The elections are due to take place on the 7th of November. Daniel Ortega is expected to win. And the reason he's expected to win is because there's been so many social gains made by the working class people of Nicaragua. Last year, while most of the economies around the world, economies were shrinking, in Nicaragua, GDP grew by 6%. Working class people have been given land and access to land. Most of the people in Nicaragua have some sort of land ownership. I live in London. I've been working most of my adult life. I can't afford land. That is why people will be going out in their millions to vote for Daniel Ortega. And regarding the sanctions, the reason why these sanctions have been imposed is because of apparent persecution of political opponents and the elections not being free and fair. Now, the bit that is not explained by the mainstream media is these figures that they claim to be political opponents were instrumental in the 2018 violent uprising and the attempted coup and overthrow of the elected government of Daniel Ortega. I interview people today who were victims of that violence. I interview Bismarck Martinez's daughter. I also met Bismarck Martinez's son, who explained about how their father was brutally kidnapped, tortured, burnt, and then killed by opposition forces. And these are the people that are now being arrested because of their role in that violence.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
belongs to a law, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is titled, The U.S. Broken Media. Stay tuned for more. In the United States of America, virtually nobody trusts what they read anymore. The United States ranks dead last among 46 nations surveyed in confidence in the press. Only 29% of Americans say they broadly believe what they read, see, or hear in mainstream media. And more than three quarters of the American public think that big outlets knowingly publish fake news. The term fake news first came into common usage around the U.S. contentious 2016 election, where both the Trump and Clinton campaigns attempt to weaponize the term against their opponents. Clinton claimed that Trump was being buoyed by false information put out by Eastern European bloggers and shared on sites like Facebook, while Trump shot back at her, claiming the likes of Clinton supporting networks, CNN and MSNBC, were themselves fake news. Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and university lecturer of history and media studies at California State University, East Bay, and Mickey Hobb, professor of social science, history, and journalism at Diablo Valley College in California, and the director of the Critical Media Literacy Organization project, Censored, have written extensively about the censorship, fake news, disinformation, and the prevalence of conspiracy theories in this free-flowing discussion in the United States. Together, the pair have written two books, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It, and the forthcoming work, Let's Agree to Disagree, a critical thinking guide to communication, conflict management, and critical media literacy. Both are experts in critical media literacy, journalism, and the history of propaganda. The power and divisiveness of social media have again been in the news recently, with former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen having claimed that the social media giant, used by 2.9 billion people worldwide for news and entertainment, had consciously promoted divisive and inflammatory content to its users, in the belief that it would generate more interest and revenue for the company, despite the dire consequences it has on society. While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever, and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Hoff and Higdon agreed that fake news and disinformation are a major problem in the U.S., but that the most pernicious examples of it do not come from Macedonian bloggers or from the gutter press, but from the biggest and most established news outlets, many of whom were integral in selling America's wars in the West Asia and North Africa region to the public. What is needed is a form of critical media literacy training, helping people understand the biases and agendas of powerful actors. Simply censoring false stories will likely not work. This is because it only treats the symptom and not the larger problem. Furthermore, it further empowers many of the largest and most influential companies in the world to judge, jury, and executioner on what is true and what is untrue.
beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
It is not a simple Saudi anger that descended on Lebanon in one night. It was not out of the blue incident that led the House of Saud to take hostile measures against the Lebanese and against even those who take the royal palace in Riyadh and all its branches as a political compass. It is not in any way or form a reaction to an old statement by current Lebanese Minister of Information, George Kordahi, that Saudi Arabia considered offensive. In fact, it is an alternative plan for all the failed tactics to sow discord in Lebanon, all of which were essentially dropped by the wisdom of the Lebanese resistance leadership. The recent Saudi decisions, which included withdrawing Saudi ambassador Walid Bukhari from Lebanon, expelling the Lebanese ambassador from Saudi Arabia, and stopping the export of its goods to Lebanon, cannot be taken out of the context of the Saudi continuous efforts to ignite sedition and fighting in Lebanon. It seems that Saudi Arabia today is playing its last card through public blackmail, which has nothing to do with the opinion of the Minister of Information regarding the war on Yemen, nor with his refusal to apologize for an offensive that he did not commit in the first place. It is a new attempt to pressure its tools in Lebanon to express with violence their disapproval of the recent decisions made by groups that do not support Saudi Arabia, and rather views it as an aggressor against Yemen, as a country that exported terrorism, and as a regime that fell in the quagmire of the Zionists in front of the whole world. In principle, Saudi Arabia was not happy with the formation of a government in Lebanon, especially after Saad al-Hariri's lost all his Saudi credit. After its flashy defeat in Syria, and with the absurdity of its aggression on Yemen, Mohammed bin Salman's solution was to keep Lebanon in a political deadlock and wait for someone to come kneeling before him asking for approval, as was the custom of his rogue family. It is originally a kingdom bearing the name of the family of those who rule it, and nothing better can be expected of it, noting that it is the only country in whose territory the principle of slavery and servitude remains a norm. Many Saudi princes are in fact the sons of slave women. Mohammed bin Salman waited. No one came along to grovel and request his approval. Freedom has a high price when the masters are rooted tyrants who always expect an obligation of obedience and submission from those they have always abused. He who sees happiness in bowing should never blame those who are accustomed to rejecting it. Aside from the current deafening media war, dealing with an entity like Saudi Arabia requires awareness and caution, as it requires dealing with the U.S., Israel, and Britain combined. Don't get me wrong here. It's not a question of strength, but of an understanding of how to confront the mixture of subordination, backward tribal mentality, personalized hatred, impaired political vision, and the highest degree of immorality that can ever be found in the foreign installed puppet dynasty. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Between Lebanon and Saudi Arabia were already strained, but they soured further last week after footage began circulating online of current Information Minister George Kordahi making critical remarks about the Saudi-led war against Yemen. Mind you, the televised interview was recorded more than a month before he was even appointed minister, which means Mohammed bin Salman only wanted a pretext to spew all the venomous drama against Lebanon to further suffocate its people. The former celebrity TV presenter's comments were a personal opinion and were made before he joined the government, which is why he publicly refused to be blackmailed by any entity. Look, I understand where Mohammed bin Salman and his entourage are coming from, though. You know, since the last person who tried expressing his opinion against them vanished after getting kidnapped and chopped up in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Bilal Laqis, academic and political researcher. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Bilal, now, the diplomatic rupture throws Lebanon's cabinet into further crisis as it tries to rally Arab support for its ailing economy. But we all know it was never about George Kardahi to begin with. What was it about then? I mean, what made Saudi Arabia lose it completely, as if it's preparing for a war against Lebanon?
Good evening to you. It seems that Saudi Arabia was not happy with anything or any political process in Lebanon for its allies or any process in the governmental institutions which does not reach a clear result. And what is this result that Saudi Arabia seeks? It's either the removal or isolation or a strike against the phenomenon of the resistance in all its presence on the Lebanese spectrum, whether its presence among its sect or its religion or on more than one level. The objective based on the Saudi viewpoint towards Lebanon was always that any scenario in order to acquire the approval of the Saudi regime would be conditional, and the approval would be based on the level that this scenario confronts the resistance. This is what has been proven for a long term. We can say the last two decades until we came to the recent events and crises, which accelerated dramatically, and we will talk about these developments. When we follow up the political path in general, we will see that Saudi Arabia has stopped at nothing, whether in political games or any attempt to confront the resistance, and it made several attempts to target the term of President Michel Aoun. Since they believe this presidency is in a state of alliance with the resistance and specifically Hezbollah, therefore it tried everything it can in order to target President Aoun, to weaken him or force him to step down. They even took a decision to target and launch a political attack on one of the former ministers who is also head of the Free Patriotic Movement. And the United States also took the decision to blacklist him on the pretext of corruption and so on.
Which brings us, Dr. Ra'is, to a very important thing that happened, because the recent Saudi decision, which included withdrawing al-Bukhari, their ambassador from Beirut, to expelling our Lebanese ambassador here back to Beirut and stopping the exports of its goods to Lebanon and Lebanon's imports as well, exports to Saudi Arabia, it cannot be taken out of the context that you are talking about, the Saudi effort to ignite sedition and fighting inside of Lebanon. The last of which was the Tayyuni massacre that happened less than 3 weeks ago at the hands of Jaja Thugs, who is, by the way, the last man Bukhari met before leaving Beirut. What was that about?
I was saying that the general path of Saudi Arabia is ascending in the level of targeting the resistance or anyone who is allied to the resistance or even all the Lebanese community, if that would assist them in striking the resistance. Coincidentally, in the last phase, it was not successful. It did not realize its objective. It put pressure on Saad Hariri and it detained him as a prime minister, and that is unprecedented in global politics. To see a prime minister being detained by another state, and he was going to be taken to jail, as you well know. But he was released through efforts of some countries like France and the US and President Aoun and other national groups. Saudi Arabia reached a state where it felt it was a total failure in the Lebanese scene, and reached a state where it was ready to use the tools it has in the Lebanese spectrum, who are known internally and even abroad for their separatist viewpoint, which does not believe in Lebanon, or the Lebanese viewpoint. They are closer to believing in confederal divided states, and specifically the Lebanese forces of Samir Jaja and the few who are with him. Also, this person, Samir Jaja, also tried to put pressure on his ally, Saad Hariri, through the Saudis, in order for them to remove Saad Hariri and bring someone who is more radical in leading a confrontation with the resistance. All these issues failed, and then finally, in the last few months, they tried to incite Jaja to commit a security act, which is known as the Tayyuni incident, in order to create a new crisis between between the supporters of the resistance and the Christian community in Lebanon, and this was also suppressed. Now, where are they going, and what do they aim with their latest step? Does this have to do with Minister Kordahi, which they used as a pretext, and the recalling of ambassadors and the high-tone political talk and the new path it has taken? This proves that all its attempts in the past in the Lebanese scene reached a dead end, and that the same path is even strengthening the resistance and the allies of the resistance. This took it to a new path, which is a focal issue, that the regional Saudi policies are only leading to more failure. Therefore, now as in the past, it wants to implicate America and France in what it views as its interests in the region. We know very well with the Americans and their relations with the Saudis, there are common interests, but they detach when it comes to their view of the future. If we see this in the political science viewpoint, there is discord on the future of interests of the U.S. and the future of interests of the Saudis. Historically, the Americans have employed the Saudis. Today, Saudi Arabia with Mohammed bin Salman is saying, either I take the legitimacy of being a king or I push the American to be implicated with me in absurd wars. As a reminder, the war on Yemen was approved by President Obama in the past not based on conviction, but to satisfy the Saudis as he was entering a nuclear deal with Iran. So many of the steps taken by the Saudis were not endorsed by the Americans, but because of the circumstances it is in, and the crisis it is living in, and the attempt to reach the throne by Mohammed bin Salman, the American was somehow giving in to the Saudis as long as they don't let go of their fixed policies. We reach now a state of rift between the vision of the U.S. and its interests, the vision of France and its interests in an issue related to Lebanon and concerns Lebanon, the Christians in Lebanon, and the role of Lebanon when it comes to the Saudis.
What I want to ask you, Dr. Bilal, where is Lebanon from all of this? We did see a meeting of a crisis cell to discuss the emergency crisis between Lebanon and Saudi Arabia, but inside the meeting, we had the charge d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, Richard Michaels, joining the crisis. When have we ever heard of a foreign ambassador join a crisis cell in a foreign country to make decisions on behalf of the people?
If we stop at the term sovereignty in Lebanon, it is in itself controversial and even a point of view, and we don't debate it much. But what I can tell you is that the Saudis today are entering a new phase as a result of their huge failure, especially in the case of Yemen. They are trying to make a certain analogy and link with the path taken in Yemen. And since there will be negotiations with Iran, and the Saudis see that the Americans are negotiating with Iran, and they are forced to negotiate with Iran, then this means that they have failed. In Iraq, they have failed. In Yemen, they have a total and strategic failure. In Syria, they have also failed. What they have left is the Lebanese scene. Based on their understanding, they believe they can make some sort of a balance. How would they create this balance? If Lebanon today is in its institutions supportive of the resistance, and the resistance is strongly present in the state, then if I, as a Saudi, am losing in Yemen, then Lebanon has to pay the price. This is an issue which is accepted by some who say they want sovereignty in Lebanon. They accept that the Saudis use Lebanon as a bargaining chip in its foreign issues.
We will talk more about this, but we are out of time for the first segment. I apologize for this, but we do have a second segment that we will discuss further this issue. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Mohammed bin Salman is trying to mobilize the entire Persian Gulf Arab states against Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
As if we are back to November 4th, 2017, the day Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman decided to kidnap the then Prime Minister of Lebanon, Saad al-Hariri, and force him to resign on Saudi state television. Last week, Bin Salman decided to kidnap the entire Lebanese government and force it to kneel before him or to leave, under the pretext of statements made by Minister of Information George Kordahi, before his appointment as a minister, by the way, in which he criticized the Saudi aggression on Yemen. Oh God, he didn't. As of 4 years ago, so was last week. As soon as the Saudi regime announced the withdrawal of its ambassador from Beirut, the expulsion of the Lebanese ambassador in Riyadh, and the cessation of imports from Lebanon, the same Persian Gulf Arab states, regional media outlets, and local Lebanese politicians themselves went out to cover the madness of Bin Salman and his decision to pressure Lebanon and push it into submission while blatantly blaming Hezbollah for it. Saudi hysteria against Lebanon in this following report.
The campaign of maximum pressure exerted by Saudi Arabia on Lebanon continues to resonate externally and locally against the background of an old statement by Information Minister George Kordahi, in which he rejected the Saudi-Emirati aggressive war on Yemen before he was even appointed as minister in Prime Minister Najib Miqati's government. Following the crisis that sparked controversy in terms of its goals and Saudi timing, Kuwait and the UAE followed in the footsteps of Riyadh and Manama on Saturday and decided to ask the charged affairs of the Lebanese embassy to leave its lands and recall its ambassador to Beirut. On Friday, Saudi Arabia summoned its ambassador to Beirut and asked the Lebanese ambassador to leave Riyadh and decided to stop all Lebanese imports to the kingdom under the false pretext of the Kordahi statement. As a result, the Lebanese ministerial crisis cell held a meeting in the presence of the deputy head of the U.S. mission in Beirut, Richard Michaels, to discuss the crisis with Saudi Arabia following the expulsion of the Lebanese ambassador from Riyadh. The crisis cell discussed the developments in relations with Saudi Arabia, noting that they will work to bring views closer, given that Minister Kordahi had made his statements about the war on Yemen before he assumed his ministerial position. Internally, former prime ministers, who have all claimed their former positions with Saudi approval, called on Minister Kordahi to resign, considering that his views constitute a severe blow to what they described as the brotherly relations and the common Arab interests that link Lebanon to the Arab countries. Maybe Yemen is just not too Arab for them. Meanwhile, regionally, member of the Supreme Political Council in Yemen, Muhammad Ali Al-Houthi, called for a boycott of Saudi products in solidarity with Lebanon and said that the latter is being subjected to a campaign of intimidation led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. These rapid diplomatic developments are putting the Lebanese government under more pressure in light of the deteriorating economic situation and the collapse in the local currency exchange rate. Meanwhile, in the kingdom, and as predicted, the Saudi foreign minister opted to blame none other than Hezbollah in Lebanon for the crisis his regime had created as part of his attempt to divert attention from the kingdom's crimes in Yemen and its gruesome attempt to punish the Lebanese people in light of their difficult economic conditions. This new cycle of Saudi hysteria towards Lebanon is but another episode of Mohammed bin Salman's twisted tactic in dealing with Lebanon for the past 3 years. Bouts of hysteria, erratic emotions, and irrational attitudes reveal the number of political and military failures that Saudi Arabia has had to endure and manage, from losing all its influence in Lebanon to losing the costly and pointless war against Yemen.
Now we continue this discussion from Beirut with Dr. Bilal Laqis, academic and political researcher. Thank you very much for being with us again, Dr. Bilal. Now, Saudi Arabia's decision to escalate in Lebanon was joined by other Persian Gulf Arab states, the first of which, as usual, was Bahrain, then Kuwait, then the United Arab Emirates. While it was reported that Qatar and Oman will not go by the Saudi route, they decided to conduct a series of contacts with other Arab countries, I mean Saudis here, in an attempt to take a decision in the Arab League against Lebanon. And mashallah, all this effort exerted to get where exactly? What would Saudi Arabia gain by pushing more sanctions against Lebanon?
If they want to turn Lebanon into a second Saudi Arabia, this is something that neither politicians, political parties, or religious authorities will accept. Therefore, we see today this Christian position. Despite the enormous pressure on the allies of Saudi Arabia, as they were unable to take a position in the face of Minister Kordahi and were unable to pressure Minister Qardahi and the government. Simply because the Christians agreed to this logic, that is, Saudi Arabia asking them to remain silent and stand in the face of freedoms in Lebanon, this means a path for the beginning of the end of the Christian presence in Lebanon through the Saudi tool in order to take Lebanon as a hostage to a barter in the Arab region in exchange for Yemen. For example, the Israelis would like to see Saudi Arabia taking this to the end against Lebanon. And we understand the position of some Arab countries affiliated with Saudi Arabia to adhere to this step. But in fact, there are those within the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council who do not want to follow this path. We all remember the experience of Qatar when Saudi Arabia isolated and blockaded Qatar and even threatened it militarily. We saw how this alliance disintegrated in the face of Qatar, where the differences between the Saudis and the Americans increased, and between the Saudis and the French as well.
But they were very frank and they were very clear. Saudi Arabia said that its problem with the Lebanese government is not that the government did not take some disciplinary measures against one of its ministers here, but simply in the origin of the idea of a government that includes ministers from Hezbollah or that represent Hezbollah in particular. Now, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan said himself that, quote, Hezbollah's hegemony, unquote, is the cause of the current crisis in relations between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon. I mean, Hezbollah received the highest rates of electoral votes in the last election and has every right to be part of any Lebanese government. How come Saudi Arabia gives itself the right to dictate to us whom should we have part of our cabinet?
Lebanon is a founding country of the Arab League, and it is long-standing in its constitution, and it fights against partisanship. Lebanon can educate the kingdom on many basic issues of public freedoms, so the kingdom must resolve this matter. Is it a state or is it a project? It exports Takfiris to us and brings them from all over the world to our region. It exports Takfiri and Wahhabi ideology. Is it a sovereign country that respects the sovereignty of other countries? Frankly, this is an essential question to be answered today in order to deal with the Saudi issue. Well, if the kingdom does not know what democracy is, I think it should learn how democracy works before it deals with a country called Lebanon, despite the many problems that exist in Lebanon. We admit that there are many problems in the building blocks of our country, but we are still proud of what distinguishes us from many Arab countries, especially the Persian Gulf countries. These are red lines in dealing with Lebanon. The path that Saudi Arabia is taking is a failed path par excellence. Perhaps, somewhere, Saudi Arabia wants to cover up an attempt to re-establish rapprochement with the Israelis by challenging the resistance with Lebanese internal affairs in order for Saudis to form an alliance with Israel or to push Israelis to undertake an adventure inside Lebanon.
There's something very important that's going to happen in Lebanon in the upcoming few months, which is the elections. And everybody's talking that Saudi Arabia does not want to see elections in Lebanon. You think that the effort of Saudi Arabia will affect the date of the elections? Will this election be postponed?
Of course, the success of events and Saudi Arabia's attempt to aggravate the situation in Lebanon further threatens the Lebanese elections. However, the Lebanese people with all their forces, even those that I disagree with in terms of their politics and their economic vision for the country, or it is possible that I even see some of them as corrupt forces, but all these forces from Muslim and Christian communities insist on preserving the elections. Secondly, the international community and the French-American vision are not compatible with the Saudi vision, which is to go towards preventing international elections. Simply because, from the point of view of the Americans and the French, who themselves are at odds with Hezbollah, they reject the path of disrupting the elections, which, if it happens, would lead to strengthening Hezbollah inside Lebanon. Accordingly, it is not required to follow a path that takes matters to a greater presence for Hezbollah. From the point of view of the Americans and the French, it is better and more appropriate to move forward with a medium to long-term strategy that begins with parliamentary elections, which might bring about some change. Saudi Arabia, frankly, is in a hurry. It is waiting for the issue of Yemen to be finalized, and it is possible that it is waiting for Hezbollah or Iran to help it end its war on Yemen, especially since this issue is complicated. Today, Ma'arib fell into the hands of the Yemeni armed forces, and soon they are going to besiege Aden, and thus, Saudi Arabia has completely lost the war in Yemen. Therefore, Saudi Arabia is trying, in one way or the other, to lure everyone into its losing wars. But today, I think that America has its priorities in China, and France wants first to arrange its house after Macron's many problems, and most countries as a whole are not ready to adopt the Saudi project. Therefore, they will try to find a formula that does not upset Saudi Arabia, as it is still a strategic ally for them, but they will search for a way for Saudi Arabia to climb down its tree and proceed Lebanon to the upcoming elections. This is an internal and international decision taken for Lebanon. It is an internal decision before an international one. Could there be developments in these elections? Can Saudi Arabia bring in Baha Hariri, a figure similar to Samir Jaja, who might take the country into dangerous polarizations and thus distort the democratic process and turn it into a kind of hateful sectarianism? All of this is possible, but elections will take place and everyone is working for it. Today, Hezbollah, which is the strongest party and has the largest popular representation in Lebanon, insists on holding elections regardless of the results.
We would have to wait and see what will happen in the upcoming few months. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Bilal Latif, academic and political researcher, for joining us to talk about why Saudi Arabia is just angry at Lebanon. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The limelight. The so-called global war on terror was not confined to operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. now has counterterrorism operations in 85 countries. We're prepared for an article written by Netta Crawford, professor of political science and department chairwoman at Boston University in the United States. The piece is titled Calculating the Real Costs of the Afghanistan War. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. United States invaded Afghanistan in late 2001 to supposedly destroy al-Qaeda, remove the Taliban from power, and remake the nation. On 30th of August 2021, the U.S. completed a pullout of occupation troops from Afghanistan, providing an uncertain punctuation mark to two decades of conflict. For the past 11 years, I have closely followed the post-9/11 conflicts for the Costs of War project, an initiative that brings together more than 50 scholars, physicians, and legal and human rights experts to provide an account of the human, economic, budgetary, and political costs of the Afghanistan war, and also the consequences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, by themselves, figures can never give a complete picture of what happened and what it means, but they can help put this war in perspective. The 20 numbers highlighted in boldface below, some drawn from figures released on Wednesday, 1st of September, by Cost of War Project, help tell the story of the Afghanistan War. From 2001 to 2021, on 18th of September 2001, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 420-1, and the Senate voted 98-0 to authorize the United States to go to war, not just in Afghanistan, but in an open-ended commitment against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States. U.S. Representative Barbara Lee of California cast the only vote opposed to the war. In other words, the U.S. Congress took 7 days after the suspicious 9/11 attacks to deliberate on the authorization of the war. At 7,262 days from the final attack on Afghanistan to the final troop pullout, Afghanistan is said to be the United States' longest war. But it isn't. The U.S. has not officially ended the Korean War, and U.S. operations in Vietnam, which began in the mid-1950s and included the declared war from 1965 to 1975, also rival Afghanistan in longevity. U.S. President George W. Bush told members of Congress in a joint session on 20th of September 2001 that the war would be global, overt and covert, and could last a very long time. He said, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every..."